It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, learn about a red state, blue state student exchange between Chicago and rural Wisconsin.
First, Wisconsin State Senate Republicans announced a plan today to end the standoff over the state budget. The budget deadline was July 1st, but lawmakers from the State Assembly and Senate can't agree on several issues, most notably the transportation budget.
Sean Johnson joins us now from the state capitol. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, what is in this new plan? What are the high points?
So it's a big plan. It's like a 600 plus page budget document. So I want to say I know everything that's in there when it was just released. But if you look at the high points on some of the issues that have divided Republicans, it's a lot of what we've heard already. So, for example, when it comes to roads, which is definitely far and away the biggest sticking point in this budget and how the state's going to pay for transportation going forward, the Senate would borrow $712 million to pay for roads. That's more than the governor proposed in his budget that he introduced back in February. And it's very far apart from where Assembly Republicans are right now. They've said recently they won't support any new borrowing if there's not a new source of revenue to pay off the debt.
So there's the Assembly Republicans want less borrowing. The Senate plan calls for more borrowing for transportation. Was there something in there to kind of, I guess, sweeten the deal for Assembly Republicans?
I'm not sure there's anything in this budget document exactly to sweeten the deal for Assembly Republicans. My impression from listening to Senator Fitzgerald talk about this is that this is kind of a way of them trying to push budget negotiations forward by putting everything on the table that they can as far as where Senate Republicans stand. They have a position on almost every issue articulated in this budget document. And so that gives them a place to kind of get budget negotiations going again. You know, just to backtrack a little bit, I mean, we've been without a budget for 18 days in Wisconsin. It's not a crisis here like it is in other states that, you know, if they don't have a budget, state government basically shuts down. That doesn't happen here because the last budget just carries over and state spending continues at those levels. But it is something that, you know, Fitzgerald even said he had hoped to have that budget done by July 1st, a new budget done. And, you know, it's something that they're going to have to answer to, Republicans are, until they get it done.
We'll spend a little more time on transportation since that's the big sticking point. But before we do that, was there anything outside of transportation that was new or was portrayed as something new and different?
So this is something that Senate Republicans have talked about doing. They kind of made it official today. They would repeal Wisconsin's personal property tax. And this is something that small businesses have wanted for a while. And essentially, the personal property tax, one of the examples that was given when this bill was up for a hearing is, let's see, your grocery store, some grocery store owners said they invest money in their businesses. They buy new refrigerators, for example. It's a big investment for them. They've just spent a lot of money. But when they do that, their personal property tax goes up, and that's paid to local governments. What this would do is repeal that personal property tax in year two of the budget. That would come with a hefty price tag if the state were to make up all the difference for local governments. To do that, Senate Republicans would not go along with some of Governor Walker's proposed tax cuts when it comes to the income tax or the sales tax. So again, this is something that puts Senate Republicans at odds with Assembly Republicans, because Assembly Republicans actually agree with the governor on that one. They want to cut the income tax, not the personal property tax.
Now, when people hear personal property tax repeal, that doesn't mean in a couple years you wouldn't get your annual homeowner wouldn't get their annual property tax bill. That's a different thing.
Right. This is really something for small businesses. It's something that they pay. And so they're saying that because of the way that the tax system has changed, it's put more of a burden on small businesses to pay the local share of the tax bill. But if you remove this personal property tax, if you phase it out and you don't backfill it with state money, you know, give local governments more state money to make up for that lost revenue, it would be a tax shift to homeowners. So the devil's in the details on that one.
Sean Johnson is with us, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, looking at a new proposal from State Senate Republican leaders on transportation and other issues. So getting back to transportation, again, the Senate calling for more borrowing after the Assembly had wanted less borrowing than in the governor's plan. Have we heard reaction from Assembly Republicans to this yet?
So far, Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke has said that, you know, it's good to see that they have a position on all the issues, time to get back to the bargaining table. But he did seem to indicate that this didn't exactly change those, you know, those fundamental differences between the two caucuses. It really boils down to Assembly Republicans taking a pretty firm stand here and saying that we want to, we either want to have a new form of revenue to deal with our state's long-term transportation issues. So we're talking about a gas tax increase or a vehicle registration fee increase, something along those lines. Or we want to scale back borrowing to the point that Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, said last week, we will support no new borrowing without a new tax or fee increase. I think Voss actually put it in terms differently. He said that he's come to accept the, quote, reality that the governor and the Senate Republicans won't support a gas tax or a vehicle registration fee or a new form of revenue, and that they need to accept the, quote, reality that Assembly Republicans won't accept any new borrowing. So that's a pretty big gulf there from the $712 million in new borrowing that Senator Fitzgerald talked about today to the $0 in borrowing that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is talking about. So they've got, that's a pretty big gulf in which they need to find some kind of a middle ground.
It seems like the gulf got bigger. Am I right?
I'd say over the last couple of weeks, yes. If you take both caucuses at their word, then yes. Because, I mean, the governor was proposing $500 million in new borrowing to kick off budget talks this year, and the budget that he introduced in February. That's historically low. But because Wisconsin's transportation debt is so high, and it would only climb under the governor's budget, Assembly Republicans said that wasn't something that they could support. So if you take that, it's kind of the starting mark, and then see Senate Republicans talking about increasing that, you start to see, you know, how they are kind of fundamentally opposed to each other when it comes to this transportation standoff.
You mentioned the bargaining table. Where is that table? Is that the Joint Finance Committee that has members from both the Senate and the Assembly? Is it the Senate and Assembly leadership meeting informally, formally? What is the negotiation going to look like?
So the Joint Finance Committee or the legislature's budget committee hasn't met for more than a month now. That is typically where this stuff has been worked out, especially since there's been single party control. I mean, Senate Republicans and Assembly Republicans have kind of treated that committee as their conference committee. You know, that what comes out of there is pretty close to the final product that they ultimately pass out of the full Senate and the Assembly. But it's not meeting. So the negotiating table has become this weekly meeting that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, and Governor Scott Walker hold in Walker's office. You presume that there's a lot of negotiating going on beyond that, maybe behind the scenes between staff, but that is where those leaders meet. You know, last week that meeting was relatively short, lasted about an hour, and that's when Speaker Voss came out and said, we're not going to support any new bonding. Senator Fitzgerald came out today with a press conference and said, here's where we stand. We'll see how that changes tomorrow's meeting.
And this is a Senate budget plan. Is there any notion that this will come up for a vote in the state Senate?
No, Fitzgerald, at least at this point, Fitzgerald said he wants everything to go through the Finance Committee. So he wants basically everything that's unresolved right now. So, you know, K-12 education funding, taxes, the transportation budget, all of it to run through that budget committee, and then he wants the full legislature to vote on it. Because if you start splitting pieces out of the budget, or if the Senate were to pass its own version of the budget and kind of have a standoff with Assembly Republicans, that's kind of a slippery slope for them. They've already sort of shown this gulf between the leaders and between the caucuses when it comes to transportation funding. It's not something that they want to encourage for months and months. I mean, I think the governor said yesterday, as long as they pass a budget by this summer, they'll be okay. It could be a few weeks, but summer is kind of the important time frame for the governor now.
Sean, thanks for keeping us up to date on all this.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us to talk about the state Senate Republican plan to end the budget standoff. They released that earlier today.
Coming up, we'll talk to two teachers who organized a Red State, Blue State high school exchange with students from Blanchardville and from Chicago. Stay with us here on Central Time.
A group of high school students from Chicago took a field trip up to Blanchardville, Wisconsin, to try to understand what life is like in a very different place. The students from Wisconsin later came down to visit their new friends in Chicago as part of this Red State, Blue State exchange.
We have two teachers with us now to talk about these trips and what their students learned. Grant Hambrick is a math teacher at Pecatonica High School in Blanchardville. Grant, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Brian Wittenweiler is a math and science special education teacher at Lakeview High School in Chicago. Brian, good to have you along.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, Brian, I'm going to start with you. You reached out to Grant in Blanchardville to set up this exchange. Mm-hmm. What prompted you to do that?
Well, at Lakeview, we have a social justice club that I'm the sponsor of. And in that social justice club, we sort of dealt with a lot of local issues and even international issues. And then the election happened, and we were sort of caught off guard by the results. And we have a fair bit of students at our school who are undocumented. We have a lot of students who are immigrants. And so the rhetoric and of the campaign and all the talk about what possibly was going to be done with undocumented students and their families had a lot of kids, like, pretty nervous. And so we thought about what can we do, you know, other than contacting all the politicians and such, what could we do to sort of, you know, bring about, like, real change? What could we do sort of in response to the election that's actually, like, productive and could get something done? And then that's sort of how the idea started.
And, Brian, was it also because your students were just, it sounded like they were wondering, you know, what's going on? We don't understand these changes and we don't understand the people who made these choices.
Yeah, that was a large part of it, too. I mean, because if you are an immigrant and you grew up in the United States, you know, this is your country. This is the country that you grew up in, where you had all your life experiences, where you feel like a part of. And then with the rhetoric, it's like, oh, you know, sort of like, what is my standing in this country? You know, what is my standing in my community and the community at large? And so a lot of that, you know, did cause, like, the questions of sort of, like, led to sort of a desire to say, hey, we do need to understand each other better. We do need to create a dialogue, because if we don't do that, we're going to continue not to understand each other and make judgments about each other that aren't informed or that hurt certain groups or other groups. So, yeah, wanting to share their story and learn other people's story was definitely, you know, part of it, too.
And, Grant, what did you first think when Brian reached out to you and said he wanted to do this exchange?
Oh, I was interested, to say the least, fascinated with the possibilities, that I wanted to change the discussion from a red state, blue state exchange to just a diversity exchange and a learning experience, because I think even in a small town, which is, yes, 98% white, rural, does not necessarily mean everybody is a supporter of a certain political party. I think there's a lot of diversity even within a small homogeneous community like ours. But so we did run with it. I had great support from my administration. Even though I couldn't explain exactly what we were going to do, they were very supportive that we should do some sort of exchange, and it would be very beneficial for our students to see a different population and exchange stories and maybe learn from them, and they could learn from us.
I'd love to hear from you both about what you did to get your students ready for this, because this could have been, I mean, had the potential to be kind of a train wreck where you have this sort of collision of cultures and ideas and ideals, too. So Brian, starting with you, what did you do to prep your students about how to approach this?
Well, and we talked a lot about it directly. The kids from my social justice club and all the kids that I had involved in the trip, and we met and we sort of discussed everything. We discussed our objectives about Grant and I had met ahead of time, too. We met a few times, talked about our objectives, And then we came up with, you know, really what this is going to be about is storytelling and kids telling, you know, their stories so that everyone can better understand each other and create like a useful dialogue. So talking about that objective with the students was really important. And then we also sort of talked about our, you know, prejudices too, you know, going into this community that's very different than ours. What you know, preconceived notions do we have? You know, how do we view them in maybe not a positive light? You know, do the students, you know, we ask ourselves, you know, are you holding any animosity or any, like, any anger towards, you know, this community, you know, and addressing that sort of head on so that we could go into the discussion sort of knowing who we are and sort of what our faults were so that we'd be open for dialogue and we could have, you know, the most meaningful so that the sharing and the discussions could be meaningful.
And Grant, what about you in Blanchardville? What did the students tell you about how they were feeling and how ready they were for this thing?
My students were extremely excited. They were worried that the kids from Chicago would find Blanchardville completely boring and wondered what we could show them that would interest them. But we also had discussions about stereotypes and what we thought the kids were going to be like. And a lot of negative stereotypes did come out. And we did have those preparations for it, but we also were talking about how to be the best hosts possible and what kind of questions we would like to ask them, what we wanted to share about our lives so they would learn more about us and what we do on a daily basis and search for common ground. I think that was always a big theme, was what do we have in common? We always mm-hmm. look at people and say, what do we have? What's separating us? What's different about us? Is it religion? Is it race? Is it whatever? But we wanted to share ourselves and see what all we had in common.
We're talking right now with Grant Hambrick, math teacher at Pecatonica High School in Blanchardville, Wisconsin, and Brian Wittenweiler, a math and science special education teacher at Lakeview High School in Chicago. And we're talking about a kind of exchange they did between their two classrooms. Kids from Chicago came up to Blanchardville and saw life there, talked about day-to-day life and got into some politics and some heavier things. And then the students from Blanchardville went down to Chicago and did the same and had a day experiencing life as the Chicago kids might experience it. And I want to get to that first exchange. Brian, your kids came up from Chicago on a bus. They landed in Blanchardville. What happened next?
You know, they were pretty excited and nervous. Also, you know, we were excited and nervous going up there and when we had the kids from Blanchardville down to Chicago, too. And, you know, the kids were sort of just talking regular kid talk, you know, on the expressway. But once we got off, you know, on the more quiet roads and on 78, Highway 78 coming into Blanchardville, everyone sort of got quiet and just started looking out the windows. And they were pretty nervous coming in, you know, and getting off the bus and seeing their school. And then we quickly got back on the bus and went to a farm. And for all the kids, it was the first time that they'd been on a farm in a rural area. So they were excited, but they were nervous too. I mean, it was in the going to the farm and starting off on the farm was like an incredible icebreaker because the few FFA kids from Blanchardville had the opportunity to, you know, to share what they do and their animals, and our kids from Chicago had an opportunity to, you know, to, they had never interacted with an animal or been on a farm. So they were excited and nervous, but at the same time, you know, they were open to experiencing something new too. So it was a pretty unique experience for them. And I think all the kids really did come into it with like an incredibly open attitude, which is what made it work.
Right. And Grant, I know that the word sincerity came up a lot, that the way the kids interacted was really sincere, especially when the first day the Blanchardville kids were showing the kids from Chicago how they cared for their cows, for instance, and life on a farm. There was a lot of sincerity and not a lot of, you know, negativity going on, even though there was a little bit of a misunderstanding in the beginning, but it sounds like sincerity overcame all that. What was your overall impression of that first visit?
I think the barriers between us just started to collapse. It was a wonderful exchange at the farm because we were just looking at animals, talking about farming. Melissa Leonard, our FFA instructor, she opened up her farm, which is a full working dairy farm, and then all the FFA kids brought their animals out, so we had a menagerie of animals, and it just allowed everybody to kind of relax, and we showed them what it was like being on a farm. We were dressed in our rubber boots, old clothes. Nobody was putting on any airs about anything. It was just exactly what you'd expect to see if you went to a working farm. But like I said, the barriers between us started to fall. There was a lot of laughter, a lot of exchange, and we hadn't really ever got into the heavier discussions, which we did get into later back at the school.
But, right, and I want to fast forward a little because we're short of time here. When yes. The Blanchardville kids came down to Chicago, it seems as though there were some relationship forms already, some bonds between these kids, and the heavier topics did come up a little bit, like immigration and politics and race and class. Brian, just briefly, can you take us through what those more weighted moments were like?
Well, our students were our Lakeview students had practiced being discussion leaders. And so before we actually went into our several discussion, which we had in Grant Park at Lakeview, after the kids from Blanchardville toured the school, we got together back in the library, and one of our students went over what was going to be a tool for the first discussion that we had in Grant Park, and that was kids created a personality pie chart. And so they divide up their personality, and so like Tiamiko, who was leading it, and it was actually her idea to have that be the discussion starter, divided up the pie chart into her ethnicity, her sexuality, her race was like a large portion. And so then we use that as sort of like the talking point. Tiamiko was just like, every day, I think about my race. That's part of who I am and part of my daily experience. And I think for a lot of the kids in Blanchardville, they were like, oh, that's not really something that we think about and that we consider on a daily basis. So that, and then we also had, as you mentioned, we also had some deeper discussions on immigration. One of the students who was leading discussion brought up that she is undocumented and talked about her life and her experiences as it relates to being undocumented. And I think that was the kids from Blanchardville handled that really well, and they had some pretty good discussions about that, too.
And we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us and telling us about this experience that you have with your classrooms, with your students. Grant, thank you to you.
Thank you very much.
And Brian, a pleasure to have you.
Hey, thanks for having us on.
That was Grant and Brian with us. Grant Hambrick, math teacher at Pecatonica High School in Blanchardville in Wisconsin, and Brian Wittenweiler, math and science special education teacher at Lakeview High School in Chicago, joining us to talk about their exchange between students in Chicago and Blanchardville, Wisconsin.
News is coming up next here on Central Time. Getting your high school diploma usually means finishing all those classes, passing most of them anyway, and fulfilling those other basics like paying any fines, meeting attendance requirements. But Mayor Rahm Emanuel of Chicago wants to add a new requirement, submitting a plan for what the student's going to do after graduation. Here's the mayor summarizing that program back in April.
Every high school graduate has a post-high school education plan because the economy requires it, and we want to make sure our kids do not see graduation from high school as the end point, but all of them have a plan, and all of them have a specific acceptance on how to go post-high school education. That is what the economy requires, and that is what they're going to need to succeed in life.
Valerie Strauss is an education writer who blogs as The Answer Sheet and writes for The Washington Post. Valerie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Valerie, can you walk us through this plan? Exactly what would high school seniors need to graduate?
Sure. Mayor Emanuel has come up with a plan in which all high school seniors who want to get the actual diploma have to have one of the following: a college acceptance letter, a military acceptance or enlistment letter, an acceptance at a job program or a coding boot camp, an acceptance into a trades pre-apprenticeship or an apprenticeship, acceptance into a gap year program or a current job or a job offer letter. They have to come up with one of those in order to be handed their diploma so they can graduate. That's the plan. That's the plan in its entirety.
And how unique is this when we look at graduation planning in states across the country?
there is a unique quality to this. Chicago announced this as the first time this was being done in the country. It's not quite the first time. There are other places that do similar similar career planning programs. Tacoma, Washington, for example, the district there has something similar where students who want to get their diplomas and graduate from high school have to provide evidence of what they're going to be doing next. But the difference is, and it's a key difference, is that Tacoma starts students with their career planning back in middle school. They have sessions with counselors. They have brainstorming. They fill out forms. They come up with career maps. And so they are ready at that point of high school graduation to say what they're going to be doing. In this case, the mayor has just decided that the high school seniors have to come up with some form of proof that they're going to be doing something. Now, that's very different than providing resources that help students think about this as they go through school.
You were taking us through the plan initially, and you said that's it, that's the plan in its entirety. And what I think I'm hearing you say is that there may not be enough there to bolster the plan, to give it the scaffolding that it needs. Is that a critique that's being made?
It is one of the critiques. One of the officials who talked about it with reporters said that there will be something like $1 million appropriated for this. And the idea is to help train counselors with this. It is not to provide new counselors. Now, one of the problems across the country is a lack of counselors in high schools. And in Chicago, there's a dearth of counselors. So with one counselor having maybe 800, 900 students to deal with, adding this to their load seems almost incomprehensible. There's another aspect to this that makes it, that some critics have said makes it almost moot and just sort of a waste of time, of everybody's time. In Chicago, anybody in the Chicago Public Schools, anybody who graduates from high school is automatically accepted into community college. All they have to do is apply. So somebody who decides they want to not really do much of anything when they graduate from high school could ostensibly apply to community college, get the acceptance, show that, and then not go. So there's a very easy way to scam this. And it makes you wonder why all the effort for something that really may be of little or no value to students. There are a lot of critics in Chicago who say that this program indicates that the mayor is a little bit of out of touch with what many of his constituents want and need.
As a pilot program, it may be that there are gaps in this plan that need to be hashed out. But what do you think about the mayor's overall mission to get students planning, to get them thinking ahead? That's what he says you got to do in the real world. So now, why not start in high school and see if that's a way to improve outcomes?
The idea of planning ahead is absolutely right. But starting in high school may be too late. Not that someone who hasn't started can't find their plan. But if you're going to construct a program, you construct it, I think, from the bottom up. So if you want, you don't construct it from the top down. So you start with whatever grade you think students should be thinking about careers and options after school, and presenting them with what the opportunities are, and having individual sessions and having group discussions and making the idea of life after school part of school, if you know what I mean.
And it sounds like that's more what Washington State does.
It does. And it was Washington State does do that. And all of the districts have this plan where students in middle school have to start thinking about it. Tacoma added the piece that is similar to Chicago's, where the students have to show what they're doing. But in the end, if a student can't provide any of the similar kinds of proof that I read to you before from Chicago, if they can't, they have to sit down with a counselor and talk about it and explain it, and they'll still get their diploma. To me, that makes a lot of sense.
We're talking to Valerie Strauss right now from the Washington Post, talking about a new proposed graduation requirement for high school seniors in Chicago. They would need to have a plan, a college acceptance letter, acceptance into community college, military enlistment, a gap year plan, a professional plan, or an apprenticeship plan to get that high school diploma. And one question that's being raised, Valerie, is this legal? What do we know about that?
Well, That is something that there is no straight answer to right now. Some people have contended it's not legal, that you can't require that people tell you what they're going to be doing, that it violates basic freedoms. And I imagine that if the district actually goes forward and tries to keep a diploma from somebody who doesn't come up with one of these pieces of evidence, that it will go to court.
Now, the idea behind this is to get students planning to succeed in later life, maybe to up college attendance. But there are those in the Chicago area who are worried it could have the opposite effect, that it could raise hurdles for students who may be already struggling, grappling with systemic inequalities, and that raising the bar is just going to make it harder.
Right. That is probably the most important critique that has been made from the community. That essentially, in the end, this is simply another hurdle that has no real meaning. Again, it doesn't offer any help to students because there just isn't the counseling force to do that. And so the critics say that if the mayor had wanted to have a real program that had practical effects, that's where some of the money would have gone to actually create a counseling force to do this. And would create curriculum and materials to help students think about this as they go through school. You know, deciding what you want to be, it's a process. And so to sort of arbitrarily say, all right, we want to see what you're going to do. You have to tell us. Every single person has to tell us or you can't get a diploma is a bit much.
And Valerie, what is your sense of the budget situation for Chicago public schools? How financially stable are they?
Well, Chicago is famously unstable. Its bond ratings are junk at this point. There's been a fight for a long time between the governor and the legislature and the city and the governor. And it's been underfunded for a great many years. And if there is a big city system that is possibly liable to go belly up, it would be Chicago. I don't think that will happen, but it's in a precarious state, and it has been for years.
Valerie Strauss stays with us now. She's an education writer who blogs as The Answer Sheet and writes for The Washington Post. And we're talking about this new proposed graduation requirement for high school seniors in Chicago. Still a proposal at this point. It's very controversial. Asking students to have a plan before they graduate, something like a military enlistment, college acceptance letter, community college acceptance letter, before that they can be handed that diploma.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think this is a good idea? Will it get students thinking about their future, as the Chicago mayor says, or do you think it's going to make it harder for some students to leave school with that diploma in their hand? If you're a parent, would you support this kind of requirement for your child? If you're a teacher, school administrator, counselor, what would this look like to you? If you are a student or recent graduate, what do you think? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@WPR.org.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up on our conversation about a new proposed program in Chicago that would require graduating seniors to submit their post-high school plans in order to get that diploma, things like a college acceptance letter, a military enlistment, or maybe acceptance into a gap year program.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see this in your school, your children's school? Why not? Is this a good way to encourage kids to plan for the future, or is there something else that schools should be doing to help in doing that? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Mayor Rahm Emanuel had this to say about reframing how we look at education.
A K through 12 model was relevant 10, 15, 20 years ago. The city of Chicago is moving towards a pre-K to college model.
I want to go to our callers now. We'll take Charlie first in Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thanks so much. I can't think of any real problem with trying to get the students to plan their lives out a little better, and to start that in the high school years is probably a great idea. The only problem I wonder about with Chicago schools is, what do you do if the schools fail to live up to their end of the bargain in getting the student ready for the plan that they choose? If they are choosing, say, college, and they are not prepared skill-wise for college, and they don't know that till after they graduate, what are they going to do to the teachers to make sure that they're accountable in preparing the students appropriately for their life after high school?
Charlie, thanks for bringing that up. And Valerie, what about that question? Who's accountable if a student fails? And is there the resource in place to have the counselors and the teachers prepare the students to meet this requirement?
Well, that question is sort of, you know, speaks to the broad issue of education. Who's accountable for what happens to kids when they get out of school? Have the schools done their job to educate kids, to prepare them for life? How much responsibility is it of the school to prepare kids for life, and versus how much is the family or the community? In this plan, there is no accountability measure, and there's almost... You'd have to set up a huge infrastructure, I would think, to track everybody to know whether they succeeded or not. So it seems to me it's a separate enterprise from proving that someone has a plan to tracking how they do it. In terms of whether the schools have the ability to take on this new responsibility, I think many of the schools have said that they probably don't. And that the money that's been allocated to help train the counselors that are there just simply isn't enough to get the counseling force that exists to be able to do this, to do it properly. I agree with the caller that there is nothing wrong and everything right with trying to have young people start to think about their futures. By the way, there is one thing I'll throw out. The Board of Education actually approved this. It's more than a proposal. It's going to happen.
Oh, the board has approved it. Thanks for updating us on that.
Sure.
And so is there anything left to stand in its way at this point?
Unless someone goes to court, but I don't know the legal aspects of it, and whether somebody has to have a grievance first before going to court. For example, not getting the degree not getting their high school diploma on paper because they didn't provide one of the pieces of evidence. I don't know that.
Take another caller now, and thanks to Charlie. This one is from Mike in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
How you doing? Thank you for taking my call. I think this is a very good idea. I think it's very important. I think there's lots of reasons to say we can't do it or we need more money, but the types of jobs that are available, the way technology is changing the world, and some of the skill shortages that we have, there's more options available to high school students, and they need to think about them earlier. They can't wait until they're seniors to decide what they want to do.
Mike,
if they do, they may lose out on some significant opportunities in their life.
Mike, thank you for that. And Mike's saying, the job market we're in, the reality is you kind of got to have a plan. You have to be thinking about it ahead of time. And we're not in that same world. That's kind of what Mayor Emanuel was alluding to in that little bit we heard earlier. He says we need to move to a pre-K to college model instead of just pre-K through the end of high school. So is there some truth there?
Well, absolutely. Students are being asked to make decisions about their lives earlier and earlier. They're being asked to do work earlier and earlier that they used to not do until, students in middle school sometimes are being asked to do high school work. Students in kindergarten are now doing first grade, second grade work. There are skills that need to be developed during K-12 if someone wants a particular career. On the other hand, there is something about the development of human beings, and while our society has speeded up and technology has speeded things up, people don't develop any different, more differently than they did before. So the notion that someone can know what they want to do without being allowed to explore during school and then during post-secondary school is, I think that's an almost dangerous thought, that people have to be tied into something and not have the ability to change their mind, explore something else. So there's that tension between what society demands and what people can actually do.
And Valerie, what if a student doesn't have the money to do their top choice plan? What if they want to go to college, but they have to save up for a couple years? What happens then?
Well, according to this plan, they would have to then have a job offer or a job, if that's what they were going to do. The plan is in some ways aimed at ensuring that no high school student who gets a degree is going to do nothing, that they have to have something to do. You know, the idea of having kids start to think about what they want to do is certainly a laudable one. You know, it'd be hard to argue against. The question is whether you put in place a program that can actually help or a program that just becomes another bureaucratic hurdle.
We're talking to Valerie Strauss right now from the Washington Post, who's been writing about a new program in Chicago that will require students to have a plan before they get their college diploma, something like a community college acceptance, a college acceptance, a gap year program, maybe some vocational training in place. And we'll take our next caller right now from Joe, who's joining us in Appleton. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi. Say, you know, I know of a company that tries to hire people with no skills, can't hire them because these kids can't add, subtract, multiply, divide. I think what they need is a plan to sustain their education. There's a lot of time to figure out what goal career I have. Kids learn that as they go through school. Let's focus on trying to teach them how to learn what they want to do and how to apply their education, because they're coming out and we can't hire them because they can't do the basics. That's the plan they should have. What are they going to do to continue their learning?
Joe, thank you for that. What do you say to that, Valerie?
I couldn't agree more. The emphasis still has to be on teaching kids the skills they need and then allowing them to apply them later as they develop their interests. I think the caller is right on.
Do you think that there is, in what you've seen, the evidence to back up Mayor Emanuel's plan, that this will help students succeed after high school? Is the evidence there?
Well, it's interesting. The Chicago district said that this was evidence-based, and when I asked them for the evidence, they didn't really have any, because it's not. This particular thing has never been done before, and there certainly is no evidence that requiring proof of doing something means that someone will do it and be good at it. So it's an experiment. My guess is that the experiment will find that it wasn't as well thought out as they thought, and they will either revamp it or do away with it.
Now, we've seen the Washington State program. We talked a little bit about that and some of the successes that it's had. This program's a little bit different. It has a little bit less of the framework. But as we wrap up, Valerie, do you see this kind of program as being maybe a wave of the future for other states to take up?
At this moment, I doubt it. At this moment, school systems around the country are having so many other issues, so many other funding problems that unless there was some extraordinary result from this, that would propel other districts to say, "Hey, what a great idea!" I think this would probably be a wait and see. Let's see what happens. The fact is, Tacoma has been doing this for several years, and Washington State in general has been doing a lot of career planning, and other school districts do career planning. But this particular issue of requiring proof is not something I think is going to catch on like wildfire right now.
Valerie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks.
That was Valerie Strauss, education writer who blogs at The Answer Sheet and writes for The Washington Post. She's been following Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel's new plan. It's called Learn, Plan, Succeed. And you can weigh in on that. Let us know what you think about it over on the Central Time Facebook page.